have with us today students from Lodi High School. Would they please stand? Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. The students are with us with the Court with Class program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The students have received briefs on the case they're about to hear and may have met with people and looked at other materials in connection with this case. And they will meet with a justice of this court at noon and be joined by students from other schools that are here with Court with Class. Also, anyone who wishes to attend that session at noon is cordially invited to do so. The group will discuss the procedures involved in the Supreme Court deciding cases, not the substance of the case we're about to hear. I'd like to introduce the court to all of you, and I'll start on my far right with Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice with whom you will meet at noon. Seated to my immediate right is Justice William Babich. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. At my left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. With the introductions made, I'll call the first case, 01-1311-CR, State versus Haynes. Representing Mr. Haynes is Mark A. Is it Huseman?
Huseman.
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 Ladies and gentlemen, counsel, may it please the court. My name is Attorney Mark A. Huseman, and with me is my wife, Attorney Sonia David Huseman, and we represent Jeffrey Haynes, the petitioner in this matter. Let me say this morning it's an honor to appear before the court. I'd like to start my comments off by indicating that for the state to assure a person that he or she has become safe from its pursuit and to thereafter withdraw its assurance seems to most of us unfair and dishonest. This case is a result of alleged acts of sexual abuse by my client upon a female victim in September 1992. Formal charges were not brought against my client until July 24th of 2000, and at that time, Haynes was charged with one count of second-degree sexual assault of a child, contrary to 948.02 sub 2 WIS stats. Ladies and gentlemen, there's no factual dispute between the parties as to when the alleged sexual abuse took place. However, the precise issue at hand in this matter is what applicable statute of limitations will we apply here? Is it the statute that was in place when the acts took place in September 1992? Or is it the statute of limitations that was in place at the time the charges were filed on July 24th, 2000? The applicable statute of limitations statute is 939.74 WIS stats, which provides that a prosecution for a violation of 948.02, which is what is charged in this case, must be commenced within 6 years after the commission of the act, or by the time the victim reaches the age of 21 years, or whichever is later. At the time the criminal complaint was filed against Mr. Haynes in July of 2000, the victim was 22 years old and was about to turn 23 on November 8th of 2000. The rendition of 973.74 sub 2 that went into effect in 1994 provides that the prosecution shall be commenced before the victim reaches the age of 26 years or be forever barred. The current rendition of 939.74 provides that the prosecution must commence before the alleged victim reaches the age of 31 years. With the victim being 22 years old at the time the complaint was filed, The state's argument is that it was not time-barred by the applicable statute of limitations in place at the time the action was commenced. What the court will be faced with in this case, and which was part of the brief of the state as well as the petitioner in this matter, as well as other jurisdictions that have looked at it, we're really going to be looking at whether or not statute of limitations are matters of substantive law or procedural law. Determining whether statutes of limitation are substantive statute is critical in this court's analysis when considering whether to continue on with the past legislative intent and previous holdings of the Wisconsin courts regarding their interpretation of a statute of limitations in Wisconsin.
Mr. Huseman, why does it make any difference whether it's substantive or not? Isn't the real key here the fact that the statute of limitations was changed by the legislature before it had run in regard to your client? Isn't that what seems to be the significant fact here, at least when looking at cases from other jurisdictions?
I would agree with that to a point, Justice Crooks, except for the fact that this court, as well as our legislature, has determined that substantive issues are to be looked at differently than procedural. I would submit to the court that if this was a matter that had previously been determined to be something procedural in nature, I think unequivocally the legislature would have that ability to retroactively do that. However, this court, as well as other courts in the country, have determined that substantive laws affect substantial or vested rights, and therefore we have to be more vigilant and careful in terms of protecting those rights, especially as we look at them in terms of retroactivity.
Well, let me give you an example. I've been trying to think of, maybe this is not very realistic, but we agree, don't we, that the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense, right?
Yes.
And it goes to, and it's substantive in the sense that if you fail to state it, you don't necessarily have waived it. Isn't that right? Or that it doesn't, the remedy is evaporated if the statute runs. State can't sue, right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, I'm thinking that suppose you have another affirmative defense and it may be necessity or coercion or self-defense. That may be a little different. A defense that the defendant has to prove, and somewhere between the commission of the crime and the prosecution, the legislature removes that defense. Right?
Right.
It's not an element of the crime.
Right.
But it's a defense. What would your position be on that? And I will ask the state the same question.
Let me present it this way.
All right, you got a better example?
Well, no, I'm going to use your example, Madam Justice, and say this, that if you're looking at an example other than the one here, where you're simply referring to coercion or privilege or something along those lines, that would be a quintessential defense that ex post facto implies you cannot touch. If you remove a defense retroactively, that is subject to ex post facto criticism, because I think inherent in the Calder decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, as well as subsequent decisions, that issue of taking a defense away is one of the bare essentials of an ex post facto analysis. So in those cases, I would say absolutely that it invokes ex post facto and shouldn't be allowed. Furthermore, we've given great thought to this issue because I had a feeling the court might ask it. When you raise issues of those defenses such as coercion or entrapment or something along those lines, that is a defense that a defendant must somehow make a showing in court, especially with entrapment. You have to make a showing in order to get to that to the jury. This case is inherently different because what we're talking about with the statute of limitations isn't even the ability to use a defense. The question is whether or not the court can even have jurisdiction over the matter to begin with. And that I see as inherently different than some of these other defenses.
What kind of jurisdiction?
Well, my understanding of ex post facto and the statute of limitations in particular is you could go all the way in a jury trial, have a defendant convicted, and later on, if statute of limitations is raised and, in fact, the prosecution commenced despite the fact that statute of limitations had run, that conviction would be, in fact, vacated because it goes to the issue of whether or not the court even had personal jurisdiction over that particular defendant.
Personal jurisdiction isn't a defense that can be waived if not asserted in a motion to dismiss?
That is correct. It cannot be waived. It cannot be waived.
You sure about that?
In the cases that I've seen, and I'm sorry, I'm at a loss to come up with the case here, I don't believe it was decided by the state of, it may have been decided by the state of Wisconsin, but it may have been another jurisdiction. But my understanding was that there was a case that ran all the way through trial, and it was a Wisconsin case, and it dealt with these two issues. There was an individual dealing with embezzlement, and I believe, while I'm looking for it, it was an embezzlement case, and what the defense attorney asked for was an alternate instruction to go to the jury for a lesser charge on misdemeanors. The court allowed it, and the jury, in fact, acquitted this individual on the felonies but convicted him on the misdemeanors. Later on, there was an appeal, and it was determined that the misdemeanors that he was convicted of actually had been time-barred by the statute of limitations, and the court, according to my understanding, did vacate it and stated that the court never had jurisdiction to begin with in order to hear the case. And so it was thrown out.
That's more like subject matter jurisdiction or competency than personal jurisdiction, I would think.
Right, and I could be mixing up those terms slightly.
Well, you'd be joining a good company.
Anyway, you didn't waive it. You preserved it. You made your motion to dismiss, so it's not an issue.
I hope. So that's really what it comes down to, I think, is we first have to determine whether we are going to continue in the vein that this court, I believe, has in saying that statute of limitations are substantive rights. If this court takes the position that statutes of limitation should be viewed as procedural, then it probably should continue to be prosecuted. But that isn't my understanding of what this court or other courts in the state of Wisconsin have done in the past. We view statutes of limitation as inherently substantive, affecting vested rights, affecting substantial rights, and therefore they should not be applied retroactively.
Let's just double back for a moment. You agree that the test that is applicable in this case for impermissible ex post facto law is that the law deprives one charged with a crime of any defense available according to the law at the time when the act was committed?
Yes.
Okay. If I understand the arguments here, it's in effect saying that the statute of limitations doesn't become a defense until there's a prosecution. So that at the time the act was committed, even though the statute of limitations was, the victim was, what was it, 21 years?
Correct.
When they came to trial and the age of the victim was increased, the increase didn't affect the defense as of the time it was committed.
Well, that's interesting because I have also looked at that issue and I suspected that the state would look at that issue. I think it's going to hinge on what this court will determine to be the definition of a defense. The way that the petitioner views this is that by enacting a statute of limitations, the legislature is serving notice that a person who contemplates the commission of an act which might be construed as criminal must be prepared to defend the act for a period specified in the statute, but no longer. So just because the state has chosen not to prosecute it in a timely fashion, i.e., prior to the original statute of limitations running, I don't think necessarily means that he can't invoke that defense somehow. He's relying on the fact that he only has to wait a certain period of time before the burden of the state coming down on him would go away. Also, statutes of limitation as legislative creatures are really speaking about what public policy is at that moment in time. It serves to protect somebody from essentially a lifetime of worrying about them being subjected to changing public policy. So I do believe that the defense, and let me add this. When someone has a case, be it civil or criminal, you come to court with a myriad of potential affirmative defenses or defenses. Doesn't mean you're going to plead them all. It doesn't mean you're going to use them all. However, they are out there. And what this legislature has done is they said, you know what? Despite the law in the books, we're going to take one of those away. We're going to take away the potential for you to use that defense. So regardless of whether or not it's been prosecuted in time or not is not the issue. It is, are they eliminating a defense? And they are. And I think that's what invokes the ex post facto analysis.
So your position is that you don't have the defenses of necessity, coercion, entrapment, privilege at the time the offense is committed. You don't know whether you'll have those defenses until trial.
Correct.
Yet, you say, if the state attempted to eliminate those defenses after the crime was committed, that would be an ex post facto law that would be prohibited. That's your position, if I understand it.
I would agree with that.
And therefore, the statute of limitations is like that.
Yes. Yes. Because, it, again, the if you're going to apply the test, we have to look at whether a substantial right is being taken away to the detriment of the defendant. I know that case law has been kind of all over the place on whether or not we're going to use the word disadvantage. And I'm not going to use the word disadvantage. I think it's a broad standard. I'm going to use the tougher standard. Are we taking away a substantial right or a defense to the detriment of the defendant? And I think clearly we are, Madam Justice, in all of those cases where you mention any of these potential defenses, privilege, entrapment, coercion, statute of limitations, if a legislature retroactively goes back and takes one of those away, that is a quintessential ex post facto situation.
It seems to me that most of the federal cases are against you, right? Federal Circuit Court of Appeals cases.
I would say some of them are, Justice, yes.
Some of them. All right. Well, we don't have to do a numbers count. I'll accept that some of them are against you. Of those that are against you, were there any in jurisdictions where the statute of limitations is viewed as a substantive rather than a remedial right?
Yeah, and that's a critical point that I...
No, but which cases are you saying they're all remedial? Or are all in jurisdictions where the is statute of limitations considered remedial?
Probably the best way I can explain that, Justice,
okay,
is that the cases that support our position,
right,
have, in fact, found the statute of limitations to be one of substance versus procedure. I can't say it to a certainty, and I'm not going to assume anything for the court today, but I will say that the vast majority of cases that would be against us, there has also been a finding that a statute of limitations is procedural in nature and not substantive. So I think it, again, comes around to that main issue that if this court and this state has determined that a statute of limitations is already viewed as substantive, then that's the analysis and framework that we should go with. And the prevailing number of cases that have found in favor of our position have indicated, in fact, that if it's substantive, then ex post facto will be invoked.
What difference does it make? That just means that we can go forward with the ex post facto analysis. That it doesn't answer the ultimate question. This gets back to Justice Crooks's point. That procedural substantive distinction doesn't make any difference to the bottom line question. And the Supreme Court has said that just labeling a law as procedural doesn't shield it from ex post facto analysis if it affects the substantive rights of the defendant. We go forward with the analysis, but that doesn't answer the bottom line question. So what difference does it make?
Yeah, I think I understand where you're going with that, Justice Sykes, and I think you're correct. I mean, there really is a two-part analysis here. I think the first question we have to ask is it substantive? And if we find it substantive, which I don't hear any disagreement on that point, then you're right. We would go to the traditional ex post facto analysis of whether or not this particular defendant or individual has been denied a substantial right or a defense or something along those lines.
Right. And when do we measure that from? The only of the three factors in ex post facto analysis that applies here is the removal of a defense issue, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And when do we evaluate that from? At what point in time? The time that the law was changed?
I think you evaluate it from the time the law was changed. Because
did your client have a statute of limitations defense in 1994?
I believe he did. Whether he was able to assert it or not, I don't think is going to be the issue because the prosecution wasn't going. But that defense was open to him theoretically at that point.
Well, if the case had been charged in 1994, he would not have had a statute of limitations defense. If it had been charged the day after the new law was enacted.
I understand your position completely.
He wouldn't have had a defense under the old law or the new law.
Right. And there's some hair splitting that goes on when we look at that issue. However, the key question I think we need to ask ourselves is not in terms of a timing issue, but literally has a potential defense been taken away? And potential would be the key. We don't know when he would have gotten charged, but the fact of the matter, he wasn't charged until a much later date. So it's speculative, but I still view it as the defense is alive and kicking until somebody proves otherwise. So at the time that the statute was changed in 1993 or 1994, this was theoretically a defense he had.
Is that accurate to say that a statute of limitations defense is alive and kicking while the statute is still running, before it has expired?
It's alive and kicking until he gets into court and has to show differently, which didn't happen. So he wasn't prosecuted, so the defense was still potentially there for him to use. Whether or not the court would have ruled it's inapplicable in his case is another matter, but he still could have at least pleaded the defense and have it reviewed at that point. So what we'd be doing is we'd be essentially jumping into the circuit court judge's robe ahead of time and saying, we're going to say that this doesn't apply. Well, we don't know that. We would have to get into the courtroom doors and at least have an attempt to assert the defense.
Isn't it important whether or not he could have pled that defense successfully? In 1994, he could have pled the defense, but it couldn't have been successful.
I don't disagree with you, Justice Crooks, but again, I think the key is whether or not the case did go forward, and it didn't. So he would have had no opportunity to assert it either way. I know we're splitting hairs on the distinction, but our position is that you have a myriad of defenses available to you at the time that a crime is committed, and that myriad of defenses is available to you until such time it is shown that you cannot use it.
So in other words, your argument is that this is a substantive right, that substantive right attaches at the time of the act. At the time of the act, the substantive right provided that the statute of limitations would run until age 21, and regardless of how many times the statute may have been changed or many years it may have been increased, that once the substantive right attaches at the time the act was allegedly committed, that that number carries with, that's your right. You have a substantive right to a statute of limitations of age 21. Is that your argument?
Absolutely. And if I can just continue on with that, Justice Walsh-Bradley, let me add this. We have a lot of discussion this morning of substantive versus procedural rights and so forth. I ask this question somewhat rhetorically. Why have we enunciated or established a difference between procedural and substantive rights? We have established a difference because they are inherently different. Procedural affects the way that a case will travel through the court. Substantive affects somebody's substantial vested rights. If there was no distinction to be made between substantive and procedural, why have the distinction? Why not just allow all laws to be applied retroactively? Well, we know we can't do that because the ex post facto analysis comes into it. And when this court or the legislature has determined that a particular area is substantive, that invokes a very serious analysis different than procedural. So I guess what I would submit is, if this court feels that there really is no difference between how we should view substantive and procedural, then we should simply strike any difference between them and just say all laws can be applied retroactively. I don't want to assume anything, but I don't think the court is going to do that. And that underlines the basic premise of my argument, which is when we have determined as a state and as a judiciary that substantive law carries with it a great set or a bundle of rights, so to speak, we have to be very vigilant in protecting that. We also have to remember that statutes of limitation are to be construed liberally in favor of the defendant. Case law across the board is pretty clear on that. So if you take that coupled with what this court has already determined to be substantive rights, the conclusion we come to is, under ex post facto, that this was a prohibited act, at least as it applies to this particular defendant. And
sure, if I can rephrase it just so that I understand your position. You're saying that at the time he committed the offense, which was in 1992, he had a right that if he was going to be prosecuted for that offense, it had to commence prior to 1999, when she turned 21.
Correct.
That was a substantive right.
Correct.
He gained a substantive right when he committed a crime.
I would agree with that. That's our position.
Mm-hmm. Because the state has a statute of limitations. Now, if it had been murder, there is no statute of limitations.
Right.
But the state says that somebody has a right to be prosecuted within a reasonable time set forth in the statute, so that you don't have a prosecution hanging over your head indefinitely, and that you're prosecuted while the crime is fresh in people's minds, witnesses for the state and for the defendant are alive, etc. That's the whole point about the statute of limitations.
Correct.
You don't even have to talk about it in terms of rights of the defendant. You talk about it in terms of the state forfeits prosecution unless it prosecutes by the time set in the statute of limitations.
Correct. I would agree with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. William Gansner, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General William Gansner and represent the state in this matter before the Court. This case arose from a prosecution that was terminated by the granting of a dismissal motion by the Circuit Court. The state appealed and in the Court of Appeals obtained a reversal of the dismissal. Mr. Haynes has brought the matter before this Court on a petition for review. This Court has correctly identified, and I think all of the questions from the Court make it clear, and the party's briefs, I hope, have sufficiently crystallized the issue. The issue is, when the Wisconsin legislature began the process more than 15 years ago of enlarging the period of time in which the prosecution of certain crimes against children, enlarging the time during which certain crimes against children could be prosecuted, and did so in a careful, limiting way that provided that an enlarged statute of limitation could apply only to offenses that were not time-barred under the prior statute of limitation when the new law took effect, did the Wisconsin legislature violate the ex post facto clause of the Wisconsin Constitution? This case, of course, arises under the Wisconsin Constitution. The defendant has not argued that independently that the action of the Wisconsin legislature or the statute involved here violates the United States Constitution. This court, of course, has said for many years that it looks to interpretations of the United States constitutional provision, and so I think the concepts involved have the case law involved this court has adopted the historic test of what an ex post facto law is. The point is, in this case, we believe on the constitutional question, which really is the dispositive question, and I want to hopefully have the majority of my comments addressing that constitutional question. But
I have
there
a question.
Is a, okay. Thank
could
you, Your Honor.
Could the legislature just say no statute of limitations on this kind of crime?
Of course it could.
And so they, instead of saying it's until she's 26 and then until she's 31, could have said no statute of limitations because of being a child, ability to communicate, remembering, et cetera, right? That would be no ex post facto, right?
Certainly not. If the narrow question that we have presented here was if at the same time the legislature said that will be true of any offense for which the prior statute of limitation had not expired at the time we make this determination.
I think that's a very good point to make. We are only dealing here with a statute of limitations that had not run
precisely
when a new statute was adopted.
Precisely.
The state's not asking us to go beyond the facts of this case.
Certainly not. We are not asking this court to decide a hypothetical question that is not presented.
Let's just assume that's what the court's going to do, and all the questioning will be for a statute of limitations that had not run as of the time the legislative change.
Exactly.
Well, what about changing another affirmative defense like coercion, necessity, privilege?
As we've argued, and as I think this court well understands from its past decisions, a legislative enactment that would remove a defense as defense has historically been understood in ex post facto jurisprudence would be a violation of the ex post facto law. To use the example, Justice Abramson, that you posed to Mr. Usman, if the legislature were to abolish, I think you said coercion?
Doesn't matter. Necessity, coercion.
Necessity, coercion, self-defense, defense of others. If the legislature were to retroactively eliminate a defense that under the law of Wisconsin was available to a defendant at the time the crime was committed, Mr. Usman and I both agree, that would be a classic instance of a violation of the ex post facto clause.
You agree that the statute of limitations is an available defense when the crime is committed, because theoretically, when it was committed, he had as a defense no prosecution if the victim is over 21, right?
I do not agree with Mr. Usman that at the time this crime
was committed. Why is it different than necessity, which would have not been an available defense in this case?
Two reasons. First of all, logically, as the Court of Appeals concluded, and I think in just simple and plain reasoning, a statute of limitation defense is never a defense at the time a crime is committed, because it is the commission of the crime that commences the running of the time limitation. The defense of statute of limitation is one that cannot be asserted until the time has expired. And as this court is well aware, when the law in this case was changed to extend the statute of limitations to age 26, it was only a year and a half after the crime had been committed. At that point, certainly, the defendant had no statute of limitation defense. He did not have a statute of limitation defense earlier in the fall of 1992 when the crime was committed.
Do the protections of the statute attach at the crime at the time the crime was committed? The protections that the statute is designed to confer?
I think the potential, sure. If the state does not act within the given time period that the legislature has determined is appropriate for commencing a prosecution, then at the end of that time period, the potential defense can be triggered, can be activated. But it is only a potential defense until it becomes an actual usable defense.
Sure. So the defense doesn't kick in until the statute expires, but the protections of the statute
precisely
attach at the time the crime is committed, so the defendant has those sort of inchoate protections that at the time the statute runs, he will no longer be vulnerable to prosecution.
Inchoate at most. That's right.
So if the legislative change had occurred in, let's say, 2001 rather than 1994, then your position would be different, I take it. Then you would say that Mr. Haynes did have the defense, and you can't prosecute him.
Yes, because it would be perfectly clear that if the legislative change were made after
the statute
of limitation that existed at the time of the crime had expired, then yes, he would. And in fact, the new statute of limitation by the express terms of the legislation couldn't have applied to him at all. That's the important limitation that I think Justice Abramson's question went to. The court is aware that the United States Supreme Court has recently granted certiorari in a far more extreme situation out of California, where California has passed legislation that revives time-barred prosecutions. That's not what the Wisconsin legislature, having had several opportunities to deal with this matter, has chosen to do.
Go ahead.
Let me put this in a different perspective. I think I know what your answer is going to be, but you know, this becomes somewhat of a highly charged case. We've got a defendant here who's no question he committed the crime. He's admitted to it about four times. And we've got a highly charged crime, you know, sexual assault of a 14-year-old. What about let's get away from those charged facts and move it on to a different plane. Would your position be the same if, say, this was a guy who, in 1992, it was alleged he committed, let's say, a fraud on his employer, and then, and it's the same statute of limitations as existed here, and at that time, and then a couple years later, the statute of limitations changes, and then something like 8 years later, this fellow is charged with fraud on his employer and says, hey, I didn't do this. Mm-hmm. I'm just looking at this, I guess, from the perspective of fairness. Mm-hmm. You know, let's assume the guy didn't do it. Mm-hmm. You know, here we're assuming the guy did it. But let's assume the guy didn't do it, but nevertheless he's charged. And, I mean, I've always looked at these ex post facto laws as sort of essentially a question of fairness. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't keep the guy, the person dangling for years and years and years. What do you think? Is it fair?
Yes. And here's why. We know on the facts of this case, because they're related in the complaint, and this case survived a preliminary hearing and probable cause was found for trial. The dismissal only occurred thereafter. There has not been a trial. But we know the allegations are, and there's no dispute, that on two occasions the defendant in this case acknowledged improper sexual contact with the victim.
That's why I'm trying to take it out
we
of
do
the
have that
charged
case.
Atmosphere.
Sure. But in both that case, where the allegations are there has been an admission by the defendant, or in any other case where the allegations are of a different character or nature, until such time as the case goes to trial, or the defendant pleads, or the case goes to trial and the defendant is found guilty, the defendant has the same presumption of innocence. I don't think there's any difference, Justice Babbage, in the state's analysis of this case, depending upon the strength of the evidence. The question is, in our view, is it lawful for the legislature, before the time for the expiration of a prior statute of limitation, before that expiration, for the legislature, which made the initial determination of what the period of prosecution should be, to change its mind and decide it should be longer? Is it fair to do so? Fairness, I think, in this context is not and should not be limited simply to looking at the effect of the change upon the defendant. There's at least two other important parties in every criminal case, the victim and the public at large, the state. If there is evidence supporting the charge, and if there is probable cause for the matter to go to trial, it should proceed. I don't see any difference, any principled basis for distinguishing, Your Honor, between those cases where the evidence may be unusually strong and those cases where the evidence may be relatively less strong.
Mr. Ganser.
In either event, the power of the state to prosecute, as granted by the legislature, I think remains the same.
Does it make any difference, as far as you're concerned, whether you put the label substantive on the statute of limitations?
No, I don't think it does at all, Your Honor. I think we get nowhere dealing with the question of whether a statute of limitation is procedural or substantive, for a couple of reasons. First of all, if Mr. Usman is right that a statute of limitation is a substantive right and therefore the legislature has no authority to retroactively change the statute of limitation, then Section 990.06 of the Wisconsin statutes is unconstitutional. Section 990.06 expressly provides that when there has been a repeal or a change of the law limiting the time for commencing an action, if the legislature expressly provides that the new period of limitation can apply, is to be applied retroactively.
That's conceded here.
Then it does.
They did, right.
And that's precisely what the legislature did in this case. So I don't think Mr. Usman is specifically arguing that 990.06 is unconstitutional, but it necessarily follows from his argument that statutes of limitation are substantive and cannot be applied retroactively. This legislature has long said otherwise, and that provision of the Wisconsin statutes has never been challenged. So I don't think he means to say that 990.06 is unconstitutional, but it follows from his argument. And what else do we get by viewing this as substantive or procedural? I don't think anything. How the statute of limitation is characterized, or what format or concept we put it into, is important in only one respect. Does it fit within one of the four or three, depending upon you how you count them, circumstances in which the historic ex post facto jurisprudence has said a law violates the ex post facto clause?
Counsel,
I'd like to.
And this doesn't, we believe. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I apologize.
Excuse me.
I'd like to return to Justice Babbage's hypothetical to take it out of the charged atmosphere, mm-hmm. as he describes it. So stay with his hypothetical, but what if the change is not a change in extending the number of years of statute of limitations, but rather a change so that there is no statute of limitations whatsoever?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you respond to that? And how, and does it make a difference whether or not a statute of limitations defense is substantive in that context?
Your Honor, I think the power of the legislature to determine the period in which a prosecution can be commenced, or in the civil area, a civil action can be brought, the time during which the pursuit of a remedy can be pursued. I think it is clear that that power is one that resides with the legislature, subject only to the limitations of the ex post facto clause. Thus, unless the change in the law within the meaning that the courts have always given to this phrase, unless a change in the law removes a defense that was available at the time the crime was committed, it does not violate the ex post facto clause. And I think what's absolutely essential to keep in mind is that all of this court's interpretations of the ex post facto clause, which have often looked to decisions of the United States Supreme Court, and all of the United States Supreme Court's decisions on the ex post facto clause, when deciding whether a law violated the ex post facto clause by removing a defense that was available at the time the crime was committed, have made clear that by defense we mean something which affects the elements of the crime. A defense within the jurisprudence of the ex post facto decisions of the United States Supreme Court and this Court has always been limited to something that makes conduct not criminal when it occurred. Removing an element of an offense to make it easier for the state to prosecute, adding an element that would make it more difficult for a defendant to defend, changing the rules of evidence so that a defense that previously could have been asserted can no longer be asserted. Those are all things that go to defense within the meaning of the ex post facto clause. And the statute of limitation, which is a limit on the time during which the prosecution can commence at all, has nothing to do with the facts or the elements of the offense. Excuse me, Your Honor.
What if a change in the statute of limitations has the effect of changing the status of the defendant. I can't think of a hypothetical, but what if a statute of limitations moved someone from a juvenile to an adult, or let's say made someone eligible for a three strikes law, mm-hmm. where they wouldn't mm-hmm. otherwise?
Mm-hmm. Then I think a real good argument could be made that falls within another of the prohibitions of the ex post facto clause. That is to say, legislative change that aggravates an offense or changes the penalty for an offense after it has been committed. And this court in the past has looked at cases that involved matters that increased the amount of time that a prisoner would serve under a sentence as an increase in punishment that was barred by the ex post facto clause. So that would fall under a different section of ex post facto jurisprudence other than what the defendant is arguing in this case. He's arguing only that the statute of limitations change removed a defense, and our contention is that's not what ex post facto jurisprudence has ever meant by removing a defense.
But is ex post facto something that some people can assert and other people cannot because the impact on them is different?
No, I don't think it varies with the individual, and I don't think it varies with even back to Justice Babich's question. I don't believe it varies with the strength or character of the evidence. I think it goes to what the nature of the legislative enactment or change was. So if the legislature decides that henceforth, not just henceforth, that there shall be no defense of self-defense in the state of Wisconsin and seeks to apply that, and the law is effective today, and they seek to apply that to an offense that was committed 5 years ago, then every person who committed a crime within the past 5 years who might have had a defense of self-defense to assert if the facts supported it would be disadvantaged, and that's the only sense in which disadvantage means anything here, would be deprived of a defense, and under the ex post facto cases of this in the United States Supreme Court, that would be illegal, would be unconstitutional. So it really doesn't vary with the individual. It varies with the nature of the change and the impact upon the class of people.
Let's suppose you had group of defendants who committed the same crime mm-hmm. on the same day,
But some of those defendants had committed other crimes about that time.
Okay.
If some of them are not prosecuted at that time and the statute of limitations is stretched out, then when they are prosecuted, they might be subject to a different status, that being that they could be subject to as they could be prosecuted as persistent offenders.
Oh, yes, and I think a real good question arises then under that section of the ex post facto analysis that looks at the retroactive aggravation of an offense in order to increase the punishment for it. And I think
that's an individual argument, not one. I mean, for some people, they could make that argument.
Right. Sure. Yeah, the ex post facto argument can only ever be asserted in the context of a particular case. I mean, this court does not sit as a body, as much as some might want it to. This court does not sit as a body to which the legislature sends every bill and says, is what we just did constitutional? Those issues are only raised in the context of individual parties who have standing to assert them. So, of course. And I must admit, there are occasions on which I wish all the bills would come before this court for review first.
Oh, thanks.
So, the point I wanted to make, Justice Prosser, is the argument of ex post facto violation can only be raised by an individual in the context of some specific set of circumstances. But the analysis will always be, did what the legislature do here violate one of the four prohibitions of the ex post facto clause? And to repeat and to emphasize, the only ex post facto prohibition that is an issue in this case is the prohibition on the removal of a defense that was available at the time the crime was committed. Mr. Usman's argument that he spent a good deal of time with you, that this is a substantive and procedural matter, to go back to a question that you raised, Justice Crooks, I don't think it means anything, because I think we have to get to the question of whether it's procedural or substantive. Does it or does it not violate the ex post facto clause? I think what's really at the root of his procedural substantive distinction is really a question of what statute was applicable. Well, we know what the answer to that is. The legislature told us what statute is applicable. It's the age 26 extension that occurred only a year and a half after this crime occurred. And we know that that's the applicable statute, and whether you call it substantive or procedural, we know that that's the applicable statute because the legislature said this change in the law applies to any offense that was not time barred at the time the new law went into effect. And this new law went into effect more than 4 years before the old statute of limitations in this case would have expired.
Counsel, your position seems to differ from the Court of Appeals' position. And I think that grabs you by surprise, but this is why I think it does,
okay.
Apparently. Are you shocked? In the Court of Appeals' opinion, as I recall it, assumed that a statute of limitations defense was a defense. But rather, the defense didn't apply here because at the time, as they say in paragraph 7, at the time of the alleged assault, Haynes had no statute of limitations defense. Indeed, such defense would not have been available until 1999. So they assume that a statute of limitations defense is a defense for purposes of ex post facto and the third element. You can't take away a defense. But they're just saying here that it wouldn't have been available. Your argument differs, and I think substantially differs, from the Court of Appeals, because your argument is premised that in the jurisprudence of ex post facto, statute of limitations defense does not fulfill the definition of defense. In all other jurisprudence, statute of limitations is a defense. You look to 80206. What are defenses? Statute of limitations. But you're saying for purposes of ex post facto, aha, we don't define statute of limitations as a defense. So I see your approach is substantially different than the Court of Appeals. How do you respond to that?
Okay. I don't think it is different. And this is an important point. We talk about a statute of limitations as being a defensive matter, to be asserted by a defendant. And it is, in the sense that any objection that a defendant has to the commencement of or the proceeding with of a criminal prosecution is a matter raised defensively. In the normal customary term that we use the word defense, anything, any objection to a prosecution asserted by a defendant is a defense. And it is a defense in that sense.
Well, that's not the way the Court of Appeals, they weren't saying Haynes has no defense. Statute of limitations defense is a term of art, just like failure to raise a claim for which relief can be granted is a term of art,
right,
and is a defense.
Sure.
But now you're going generic on me, and you're saying, we're using this term generically and not as a term of art. And although, again, throughout the civil procedures, because that's what comes to my mind, 80206, saying that listing the laundry list of affirmative defenses, and of course statute of limitations is in there, but you say, no, for purposes of ex post facto, statute of limitations is not a defense. And why, you say? It's not a defense because it isn't an element of the crime. So you're defining it very differently than you're saying, because it's not an element of crime, statute of limitations is not a defense for ex post facto law. Is that your position?
Sure, because that's what the ex post facto jurisprudence of this Court and the United States Supreme Court requires.
Okay.
But
that's different than the Court of Appeals.
Well, I not to quibble, but here's why I think it's really not. I think what paragraph 7 said, and the very first question that the defendant raised in the Court of Appeals in response to the state's appeal was, well, which statute of limitations is applicable here? And the Court of Appeals easily answered the question by saying, we know what statute is applicable. The legislature told us it applies here. So the Court was, when it said this defendant didn't have a statute of limitation defense at the time the crime was committed, was there was no statute of limitations objection of any kind that he could raise at the time the crime had occurred. Okay, so assuming we call it a defense, he didn't have it at the time the crime occurred. Okay, and that is the test under ex post facto. It's a violation of the ex post facto law to remove a defense that was available at the time a crime occurred. So the first thing I think the Court said, and I think this is what paragraph 7 means, was assuming that this was statute of limitation violation is a defense, it didn't exist at the time he was charged, because a statute of limitations defense can never, excuse me, not charged at the time the crime is committed, because a statute of limitation defense never exists and never can be pled at the time a crime occurs. That's when it begins. The Court then proceeds to discuss the ex post facto issue and looks at the mountain of case law from other states that have held that it is not a violation of the ex post facto clause. It does not remove a defense available at the time a crime occurred for a legislature before the expiration of a prior time limit to extend the time limit. So I think what the Court was doing was both dealing with statute of limitation. If we call it a defense, was it available? No. And then two, even if it had been available, is it the kind of defense that the ex post facto clause prohibitions reaches? And the answer that the Court reached in the second part of its opinion, in fact the longer analysis of the opinion, is no. Not a single court in the country has so ruled.
Mr. Gansner, are you done answering?
Yes, I am, I think.
Are you finished?
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm going to throw another hypothetical at you, and I guess I apologize in advance that it may have absolutely no relationship whatsoever. But
If I faint away, you'll know I agree.
I'm trying to get my arms around what kind of a creature we're dealing with here mm-hmm. when we talk about statute of limitations. So mm-hmm. let me give you three dates. 1990, bank fraud, there's an alleged bank fraud committed, and there is no statute of limitations.
None. Okay.
In 1992, the legislature enacts a six-year statute of limitations on that act, on bank fraud. Okay? Mm-hmm. You've got to bring the act within 6 years. Mm-hmm. In 2000, this guy's prosecuted for bank fraud that occurred in 1990. Mm-hmm. Means the six-year statute that was in effect in 1992 has already run. Mm-hmm. But this guy didn't have a statute of limitations applicable to him when he committed the act. Can the prosecution go forward?
May I ask a question?
Sure.
What did the legislature say when it eliminated the statute of limitations? When it imposed the six-year. Did it say that the six-year limitation would apply to prior acts?
Silent.
Okay. Then under 990, I think the answer then is provided for us by statute in 990.06, because 990.06 says that whenever a repeal or a change in a statute of limitation occurs, the new limitation shall apply only to cases subsequent to the time when the repealing act takes effect, and the repealed act shall be held to continue in effect unless the legislature expressly provides otherwise. I think that's the answer, Your Honor.
Okay. I don't know if that means anything, but...
No.
I mean, I don't know if it's relevant, but I think it might be, but I can't answer that right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, but I think that's the answer to the question. Mm-hmm. And I think 990.06 speaks to it clearly. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Gansner. Mr. Huseman?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay.
I want to go back to the first hypothetical that Justice Bablish mentioned. I really can't remember what the hypothetical was. It was either theft or fraud or something along those lines.
We're dealing with the bank fraud. Okay, with a guy who just says, I didn't do it.
Okay. I didn't do it.
You. It's you or me.
Okay. I think that hypothetical is critical in understanding why we have determined there's a difference between substantive and procedural law and why we view them differently. Statutes of limitation are creatures or animals that are designed to protect people from stale claims where evidence dissipates, washes away, witnesses die, so on and so forth. That is a protection there for a reason. Now, if we're going to use Justice Bablich's example, we really could theoretically have a point where there is no end game. We could have an individual that denies that he ever committed this crime, and we could have a legislature that, infinitesimally could be changing the statute of limitations. At what point do we say to ourselves, using the fairness standard here, at what point does it become impossible for this individual to defend against such charges? And that's why this situation is so much different with statute of limitations, because we aren't talking about somebody's ability to judge or weigh evidence in the courtroom. We are talking about whether this matter should even be before the court at all, and whether or not this individual should have to defend against charges that might be so old that there may be really no evidence to help this individual either way. And that, I think, is an analysis that should be used in this case. Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with anybody in here. Obviously, the facts are the facts in this case, and I agree with the highly charged comments earlier. But that isn't the issue. The issue is we should assume that anybody that would come up and face such a thing that has pled not guilty, where evidence might be subsiding over time, where witnesses might die, how long do we want them to face this type of situation? If the legislature saw fit, they should have eliminated the statute of limitations in this case, and they haven't done that. They also have recognized that at some point there needs to be some cutoff so that we can protect basic rights of defendants to actually defend against an allegation. And I think that's crucial. And that is why we continue to have a difference in how we view substantive versus procedural, because there are vested rights that are affected. It's also interesting to note this discussion of individual versus collective effects of such a law as what we're looking at. There has been a great deal of discussion today regarding the availability of the defense of statute of limitations for this individual. But perhaps the key component or key question we should ask is not how it applies to this individual, but rather, has the legislature unilaterally stripped a defense away, period? And that's what they've done. They have unilaterally stripped that defense. It is irrelevant whether it's Mr. Haynes that would be before this court or any other individual that would be charged under the statute. It meets the ex post facto definition because a defense has been eliminated. And as long as that situation is in place, ex post facto is then activated and we have to proceed accordingly.
Really only a theoretical defense under the facts of this case, right?
I would agree.
The substantive rights are incapable of being asserted until after the statute runs. So it's.
I would agree, Justice Sykes, but there is no case law out there that seems to differentiate between a theoretical defense and an actual defense. The test is simply, has the legislature eliminated it? And they have in this case.
Well, the language is an available defense. And the statute of limitations defense does not become available until after the statute runs. And isn't that when the substantive rights in the statute kick in?
Well, I think the substantive rights kick in the minute that the individual commits the crime, because at that point the individual is relying on the law that is currently in place. And that is how this court and other courts have determined it to be substantive, because it is something that this individual is relying on. It's not existing in a vacuum. It's not a legal fiction. It's something that an individual relies on. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Gansner. Thank you, Ms. Eastman, for your arguments this morning. And this closes our hearing on 01-1311 CR State v. Haynes. The court will take a brief recess so these students may leave and the other students may come in. And we'll see you all at about noon when you meet with Justice Bradley.
Nice job.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Yeah, no, this will be really